I want to start today by taking you into a scenario that is probably the nightmare of every emergency room physician, whether they admit it or not.
Oh, absolutely.
Imagine a patient comes through the doors. It's chaotic. You know, monitors are beeping, nurses are shouting out vitals. And this patient, let's say it's a 66-year-old man, has just been brought in because he had a massive seizure.
Which in itself is a high-stress situation. I mean, your first thoughts are airway, breathing, circulation.
Right.
You're worrying about the airway. You're worrying about stopping the convulsions if they're still happening.
Exactly. So the team goes into seizure protocol. They're thinking neurologically. They're thinking about the brain.
Is it a tumor? Is it a bleed? Is it epilepsy?
They stabilize him. They send him for a CT scan of the head.
Yeah.
They're looking up.
And that is the standard of care. I mean, it makes perfect sense. You look for the fire where you see the smoke. The smoke, in this case, is the seizure.
But while everyone is staring at the brain, trying to find the electrical short circuit, there is a ticking time bomb in the man's chest that nobody is looking at. And by the time they realize the problem isn't in his head, but in the main highway of his circulatory system, it's often too late.
That is a terrifyingly accurate picture of what we call anchoring bias. You anchor onto the obvious symptom, the seizure, and you can miss the silent killer lurking underneath.
Today, we are going to dismantle that scenario. We are diving into a medical mystery that completely flips the script on one of the most dangerous conditions in the human body, arterial dissection.
A terrifying condition.
Specifically, the idea that a seizure isn't just a symptom of a torn artery, but that the seizure itself, the sheer violence of the body's own electrical storm, can physically rip the heart apart.
It sounds like something out of a medical horror movie, doesn't it? The idea that the brain can essentially attack the heart with such force that it causes a mechanical failure?
It does. And we're looking at a fascinating and, frankly, kind of scary paper. It's titled Sudden Unexpected Atraumatic Arterial Dissection-Related Death After Seizures.
A mouthful of a title.
A bit of a mouthful, yeah. It was published just recently in 2024 in Seizure, European Journal of Epilepsy. The authors are Jose Vega, Naros Karim, and Caroline Hall.
And credit to them, because they are wading into some very, very murky waters here. They are challenging a timeline that medicine has, well, has accepted for decades.
It's the classic chicken or the egg dilemma.
Precisely. But with, you know, lethal stakes.
So the mission for this deep dive is pretty clear. We need to explore this new phenomenon they're proposing. They've actually given it a name, a new acronym to add to the medical dictionary, SWEDAS.
SWEDAS. Sudden Unexpected Atraumatic Arterial Dissection-Related Death After Seizure.
It's a lot to say, but every single word in that acronym is heavy with implication.
Everyone.
We're going to break down how a seizure can physically tear an artery. We're going to look at the smoking gun evidence they found in 45 detailed case reports. And we're going to talk about why this might completely change how we understand sudden unexpected death in epilepsy, or SUDEPI.
And I think by the end of this, you're going to have a very different respect for the sheer physical power of a seizure. It's not just lights flickering in the attic. It's an earthquake that can shake the whole house down.
Absolutely. Okay, so before we get to the earthquake,
yeah,
let's define the players. We keep throwing around the word dissection.
Right.
And I feel like for a lot of people, that word brings up memories of like high school biology and the smell of formaldehyde. You know, dissecting a frog.
I can assure you, an arterial dissection in a living human is a very different, very violent event. Not at all like a careful incision with a scalpel.
So walk us through the anatomy. When we say arterial dissection, what is actually happening inside that pipe?
You have to stop thinking of your arteries, and specifically the aorta, which is the biggest one, the main trunk line out of the heart, as just a simple rubber tube.
Right.
It's a complex, multi-layered structure. Think of it like a very high-tech, reinforced hose that has three distinct skins, or layers.
Layers, got it. What are they?
Okay, so the innermost layer, the one that's actually touching the blood, is called the intima. It's incredibly smooth, it's slick, it's designed to let blood flow without any friction at all.
Like the Teflon coating on a pan.
That's a great analogy, exactly. Then, wrapping around that, you have the media. This is the muscle layer. It's thick, it's tough. That's what gives the artery its strength and its elasticity, its ability to expand and contract with every heartbeat.
Okay, so that's the middle layer.
And then on the very outside, you have the adventitia, which is sort of the protective wrapper. It holds everything together and has nerve endings and blood vessels that feed the artery wall itself.
So intima on the inside, media in the middle, adventitia on the outside.
A dissection happens when that inner layer, the intimaire, just a small rip,
just a little tear.
It can start that way. But because the blood in there is under incredibly high pressure, it forces its way into that tear. It literally wedges itself between the layers of the artery wall.
So it's like water getting under wallpaper and peeling it off the wall.
That is a perfect analogy. It is exactly like that. The blood creates a false lumen, a false channel. It starts tearing the layers apart, tunneling down the length of the artery, driven by the force of every single heartbeat.
And that sounds bad. What does that do?
Well, it can do a couple of catastrophic things. One, this false channel can get so big that it balloons out and pinches off the real channel, the true lumen. That stops blood flow to your kidneys, your legs, your gut, or your brain.
Like causing a stroke.
Instantly. Or two, it can weaken that outer wall, the adventitia, so much that it just bursts.
And if the aorta bursts?
It is catastrophic. It's one of the most lethal events in medicine. You bleed out internally in minutes.
Now, the paper focuses on AAAs. Spontaneous atraumatic acute arterial dissections. The key word there being atraumatic.
This is a crucial distinction. It's everything, really. If you get into a car accident and your chest hits the steering wheel at 60 miles an hour, you can tear your aorta. That's traumatic.
Right.
That makes sense. Physics explains that easily. A massive deceleration injury.
Or if you fall off a ladder. Or some other kind of blunt force trauma.
Exactly. But these cases are spontaneous. These are people who are just living their lives. Maybe they're sitting on the couch watching TV. Maybe they're sleeping. And suddenly, for no apparent external reason, the vessel tears itself apart from the inside.
And usually, if you have a dissection, you know it.
Yep.
This isn't a silent killer in the sense that you don't feel it happening.
Right? No, absolutely not. The pain is legendary in emergency medicine. It's one of those hallmark symptoms. Patients describe it as a tearing or ripping sensation.
Visceral language.
Very. If it's an aortic dissection, it's usually felt in the chest or radiating through to the back, right between the shoulder blades. It is often described as the single worst pain the patient has ever experienced. Worse than childbirth, worse than a kidney stone, worse than anything.
And if it's in a different artery, like a coronary artery dissection.
Then it presents like a massive heart attack, crushing chest pain. If it's in the neck, the carotid or vertebral arteries, you might get severe neck pain, a thunderclap headache, or immediate stroke symptoms like facial drooping or weakness on one side.
Okay, so we have established that dissections are incredibly painful and incredibly dangerous. Now let's talk about the traditional assumption, the medical dogma that this paper is questioning.
Right. The dogma is all about the timeline. For decades, the narrative has been linear and, you know, it seems logical. Step one, the dissection happened.
For whatever reason.
For whatever reason. Maybe you have uncontrolled high blood pressure. Maybe you have a connective tissue disorder like Marfan syndrome. And the artery wall just gives way. It tears.
And that causes the immediate excruciating pain.
Right. Step two, that tear disrupts blood flow. If it's a carotid dissection, a clot might form and fly up to the brain, causing a stroke. Or the pain is just so intense and the blood pressure drops so suddenly that the patient faints. That's called syncope.
Okay. And then step three.
The brain, which is now either starving for oxygen or directly irritated by a clot or a bleed, reacts by seizing.
So in the traditional story, the seizure is the result. It's the final domino to fall. It's a symptom of the brain injury caused by the dissection.
Correct. Dissection, right arrow, brain injury, right arrow, seizure. It's a tidy, logical progression. It makes sense physiologically. It's easy to teach.
And because it makes sense, doctors stop asking questions. They see the dissection, they see the seizure, and they assume A caused B. End of story.
That is the danger of a tidy narrative. It's compelling, it's simple, but it can blind you to the outliers, to the cases that don't fit the pattern.
And that's what Vega, Karim, and Hall found. They found a glitch in this matrix. They started noticing these case reports scattered through the literature where the timeline just didn't fit. It was backwards.
They found patients who were completely asymptomatic, no tearing pain, no headache, no chest pressure. They were fine one moment, and then, bam, a massive seizure out of the blue.
And only after the seizure, when the doctors did the workup, did they find the dissection.
Which begs the question, if an aortic dissection is the most painful thing a human can experience, how could they be sitting there comfortably watching TV right before the seizure?
It suggests the dissection wasn't there yet.
It implies the seizure was the inciting event, the seizure started, and the sheer violence of that event caused the tear.
This is where we get into the detective work. Because you can't just make a claim like that based on a hunch. It's a huge claim. You need data.
And getting that data is really hard because these are rare events. It's the intersection of two relatively uncommon things. You can't exactly run a clinical trial where you induce seizures in people with high blood pressure to see if their hearts explode.
That would be unethical, to say the least.
A slight understatement, yes. Yeah. So they had to look backward. They did what's called a retrospective review.
They scoured PubMed, the big medical database.
Right. They looked for every single case report ever published that combined the terms seizure and dissection, aortic, carotid, vertebral, renal, mesenteric. I mean, they cast a very wide net.
I want to touch on their exclusion criteria because there was one detail that I found both hilarious and terrifying in a very 2024 kind of way.
I think I know which one you're referring to.
They explicitly noted in their methods that they excluded any papers written by ChatGPT.
It's a sign of the times, isn't it? We are now living in an era where AI hallucinations are a genuine confounder in scientific literature. Researchers have to actively filter out fabricated case studies written by a large language model.
It's wild to think that a medical review in 2024 has to have a no-robots filter just to ensure the patients they are studying actually existed.
It really is. But it speaks to the rigor of this team. They didn't just scrape data, they verified it. They also, as you said, excluded traumatic cases, the car crashes we talked about, because those are messy. They add too many variables.
They wanted the pure spontaneous cases.
And they required proof.
Meaning imaging.
Yes. If the case report said, we think it was a dissection, but didn't have an MRI, a CT angiogram, or an autopsy photo to prove it, it went in the bin. They wanted confirmed cases only.
So after all that filtering, what was the final sample size? How many cases did they end up with?
They ended up with 45 case reports.
Now I can hear a skeptic listener saying, 45, that's it. That's a tiny study. And in some contexts, they'd be right.
In the world of, say, a study on a new cholesterol drug where you need tens of thousands of people, yes, 45 is small. But we are talking about a rare, often fatal intersection of two specific conditions. Finding 45 well-documented, pathologically proven cases is actually a significant, coherent data set. It's enough to see a signal in the noise.
And the signal they found came from how they split these 45 people up. They created two groups based on one simple variable time.
This is the core framework of the entire paper. It's brilliant in its simplicity. You have the SAFO group and the SADO group.
Let's break those down. First, SAFO, what does that stand for?
SAFO is seizures after onset. These are the patients that follow the rules. They fit the textbook.
The traditional group.
Exactly. They had the classic symptoms first, the ripping pain, the dizziness, the neurological deficits. And then, sometime later, they had a seizure.
And how much later, on average?
The paper notes the average delay was about 6.7 hours between the start of dissection symptoms and the seizure.
So there was a clear sequence of events.
A very clear sequence. But then you have the SADO group, seizures, AT, or before onset.
The rebels.
The mystery cases. The ones that break the model. These are the patients where the seizure was the very first sign of trouble. No prior pain, no warning. Just a seizure.
Now, if the traditional dogma is right, the SADA group could be tiny. You know, maybe one or two freak occurrences where the patient just had an incredibly high pain tolerance or something.
That's what you would expect. A handful of outliers. But that's not what they found. Not even close.
What was the split?
Out of the 39 spontaneous cases, they separated out 6 purely traumatic ones. For comparison, 21 were SAFO and 18 were SAFO.
Wait, 21 to 18, that's nearly a 50-50 split.
It was 46.2% to be exact.
Yeah.
Nearly half of the patients with seizures and spontaneous dissections did not fit the traditional narrative. That is not an anomaly. That is a pattern.
Wow.
That is a massive population of patients whose pathology is likely being misunderstood at a fundamental level.
So for nearly half these people, the seizure came first. But the authors didn't just stop at the timeline. They knew that wasn't enough. They had to look for other evidence to prove the seizure was the criminal here, not just a bystander.
Right. They looked for the smoking gun, or rather the absence of one. They looked at the brains of these patients.
This part is fascinating. Walk us through the focal brain lesion theory.
Okay. So let's go back to the traditional idea. Dissection causes seizure. For that to happen, the dissection usually has to block blood flow to a specific part of the brain.
Like we said, it causes a stroke, ischemia, or it causes swelling.
Right. And a stroke, an acute ischemic event, it leaves a mark. It leaves a very clear mark on an MRI scan, especially on certain sequences like a DWI, a diffusion-weighted image. You can see the dead or dying tissue light up like a Christmas tree. You can see the lesion.
So if the dissection caused the seizure, you should see the stroke that triggered it. You should find the footprint of the crime.
Exactly. The cause of the seizure should be visible on the brain scan. So in the SAFO group, the traditional dissection first group, what did they see?
What did they find?
100%. Every single patient in the SAFO group who had an MRI showed an acute focal brain lesion.
100%. That's a slam dunk. The dissection caused a stroke. The stroke caused a seizure. Case closed for them. It confirms the traditional model perfectly.
Case closed. It works exactly as we thought. But now, let's look at the SAFO group, the seizure-first mystery group.
What did their brains look like?
This is the kicker. Only 54.5% of the SAFO patients who had an MRI showed acute lesions.
Roughly half of them had normal brains, at least no new damage.
In the context of an acute injury, yes. They had this massive violent event, a dissection, and a seizure. But almost half of them had no new brain damage that could explain why the seizure started. The MRI was, for all intents and purposes, clean of any acute cause.
So if there's no stroke causing the seizure.
Then the seizure came from somewhere else. It was a primary event. It was an electrical storm that started on its own, likely due to a pre-existing condition like epilepsy, or a lowered seizure threshold from something else entirely, but not because of a freshly blocked pipe to the brain.
This effectively rules out the dissection first theory for a huge chunk of those patients. You can't have a dissection cause seizure without the brain damage to prove it?
Exactly. It decouples the two events neurologically. The seizure is the cause, not the effect.
They also looked at the patient's medical history, which I think is the third pillar of their argument, and it's just as strong.
It's a very strong one. If you are claiming that the seizure is the primary event, it helps your case if the patient has a history of, well, having seizures.
Right. If I've never had a seizure in my life, and I have a dissection, and then I seize, it's probably the dissection.
Yeah.
But if I have a known diagnosis of epilepsy,
then it's much, much more likely that you're just having a seizure because of your epilepsy. And the dissection is something new and terrifying that happened because of it.
And the data bore this out, right?
Massively. In the SAFO group, the seizure first group, a full third, 33.3% of patients had a known pre-existing history of epilepsy.
A third of them. And in the traditional SAFO group?
Only 4.8%. Basically one patient.
Wow. That is a huge discrepancy. It's not even close.
It was a chasm. It tells us that patients with epilepsy are disproportionately represented in the seizure first group. These are likely what we call breakthrough seizures, seizures that happen despite being on medication.
And the paper highlighted one specific case that I thought just nailed this down perfectly, the case with the medication withdrawal.
Yes, the case reported by Amin and colleagues. This is almost the proof of concept case. It's the perfect natural experiment.
Paint the picture for us.
So you have a patient with a known diagnosis of juvenile myoclonic epilepsy, or JME. This is a common, well-understood epilepsy syndrome. They are on medication lamotrigine to control it.
Standard stuff. They're being managed.
But then, for whatever reason, the patient stops taking their meds. About a month later, they are admitted to the hospital with a massive generalized tonic-clonic seizure.
Now, any neurologist listening to this knows exactly what happened. You stop your anti-seizure meds, you are going to seize. That is cause and effect 101.
It's the most predictable thing in neurology. The seizure was caused by the lamotrigine withdrawal. There is no mystery there. The trigger is known. But here's the twist. After they stabilize the patient from the seizure, they find a vertebral artery dissection in the neck.
So did the dissection cause the seizure?
It's impossible. We know why the seizure happened. It happened because of the medication withdrawal. Therefore, the dissection must be secondary.
The seizure happened first, and the violence of that withdrawal seizure tore the vertebral artery.
It's Sherlock Holmes logic, right? Once you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth.
And that leads us to the improbable part, because for a long time, doctors didn't really think a seizure could tear an artery. It just didn't seem mechanically plausible.
That's the big psychological hurdle here, right? We think of seizures as electrical, a software problem. We think of arteries as these tough, pressurized rubber tubes, a hardware problem. How does a brain spark physically snap an aorta?
Seems like two different worlds.
To understand the how, we have to look at the absolute storm that happens inside the body during a generalized seizure. It's not just muscles twitching. It is a chemical and hemodynamic explosion.
The paper talks about the catecholamine surge.
Yes, catecholamines. Think epinephrine, which is adrenaline, and norepinephrine. When you go into a generalized tonic-clonic seizure, your brain dumps these fight-or-flight chemicals into your bloodstream at levels that are just off the charts, far higher than you'd get from running from a bear or giving a public speech.
We're talking fight or flight on steroids.
We're talking about a survival mechanism gone completely haywire. And this surge does three things simultaneously that spell absolute disaster for the aorta and other major arteries.
Okay, break them down for us. Number one.
Extreme vasoconstriction. The adrenaline hits the receptors on the blood vessels and tells them to clamp down hard.
So the pipes get smaller, the diameter shrinks.
Much, much smaller. At the same time, number two. A massive, sudden spike in blood pressure. A hypertensive crisis. Because the pipes are smaller and the heart is starting to race, the pressure inside that closed system skyrockets.
Well, how are we talking?
In a severe seizure, systolic pressure can jump from, say, 120 up to 250 mmHg in a matter of seconds. It's a hydraulic hammer blow from the inside.
Okay, so you have tiny pipes and massive pressure. What's number three?
Increased cardiac output and tachycardia. The heart is beating faster and harder, trying to force blood through those clamped down vessels. It's a pump going into overdrive against a blocked system.
This combination creates what the paper calls shear stress. What is that?
Imagine a fire hose. If you're running water through it smoothly, it's fine. But if you kink the hose and then turn the water pressure up to maximum, what happens? The water inside stops flowing smoothly. That's called laminar flow. And it becomes turbulent. It starts thrashing and swirling violently against the inner walls of the hose. That is shear stress.
And if the hose has a weak spot?
It bursts. Or, in this case, the inner lining, the intima, tears. And this is where we have to talk about a critical piece of anatomy that we skipped earlier, but we need now. The vasa vasorum.
The vasa vasorum. That sounds like a spell from Harry Potter.
It does, doesn't it? It's Latin for the vessels of the vessels.
Wait a minute. The blood vessels have their own blood vessels.
Well, big ones do, yeah.
Yeah.
The aorta is so thick because it has to handle all that pressure coming out of the heart that oxygen from the blood flowing inside it can't diffuse all the way to the outer layers of the wall. The outer muscle layer, the media, would starve.
So it needs its own dedicated blood supply.
It needs its own tiny network of capillaries that feed the aorta wall itself, keeping that muscle tissue alive and healthy.
Okay, so little pipes feeding the big pipe. I get it.
Exactly. Now, here is the problem. What is one of the first things to get damaged by years and years of chronic hypertension? Tiny little blood vessels.
Oh.
Chronic high blood pressure crushes the vasa vasorum. It damages those tiny little pipes that feed the aorta.
So the aorta's own food and oxygen supply gets cut off.
Correct. And when the tissue of the aorta doesn't get oxygen, it starts to die. It becomes weak, brittle, and necrotic. This condition is called medial necrosis. The strong, elastic muscle layer in the middle of the aorta wall literally starts to rot from the inside out.
Gosh, that's a gruesome image. So you have a rotting, brittle wall.
A pre-weakened structure.
Yeah.
And then the seizure hits. You get the catecholamine surge. You get the hydraulic hammer blow of 250 mmHg. And you get the twisting physical torque of the body's convulsions.
And the brittle wall just gives up.
It shears. The intima tears. The blood rushes in. And you have a dissection.
It's the perfect storm. You have the pre-existing condition, the weak wall caused by hypertension, and then you have the acute trigger event, the seizure.
And the paper actually provides biological proof that this storm happened. They looked at white blood cell counts in the patients.
Leukocytosis.
Right. Usually when you see a high white blood cell count, you think infection, you have the flu, your count goes up. But these patients didn't have infections.
So why were their counts high?
It's a known phenomenon called post-convulsive leukocytosis. It is a well-documented reaction to extreme physical stress and that massive catecholamine release. It's essentially a biological receipt. It's proof that the body went through a massive stress event.
And the Seisoto patients, the ones who seized first, had significantly higher white blood cell counts than the others.
Which confirms the intensity of the seizure that caused the tear. The body is telling you, I just went through a war.
This is heavy. Mm. It really reframes the danger of a seizure. It's not just about hitting your head or biting your tongue. It's about the risk of internal structural failure.
And that failure can be fatal. Which brings us back to the acronym we teased at the beginning, SWIDAS.
Sudden Unexpected Atraumatic Arterial Dissection Related Death After Seizure.
The authors are proposing this as a distinct clinical entity, a specific cause of death that we need to start looking for and tracking.
And we need to track it because right now it's probably getting buried under another more famous acronym, SUDEEP.
Ah, yes. SUDEEP. Sudden Unexpected Death in Epilepsy. This is the specter that hangs over every person with epilepsy in their families. A patient, often young, goes to bed or has a seizure and simply dies. And in many cases, we don't know why.
The paper makes a really important point about the classification of SUDEP, the difference between definite SUDEP and probable SUDEP.
This is a crucial distinction that causes a lot of pain and confusion for families. Definite SUDEP is a diagnosis of exclusion. It's when you do a full autopsy, you look at everything, heart, lungs, brain, toxicology, and you find nothing, no anatomical cause of death.
The truly unexplained death. The theory is it's a shutdown of the brainstem, stopping breathing.
Right, but probable SUDEP, that's what gets written on the death certificate when no autopsy is done. The patient had epilepsy, they died suddenly and unexpectedly, we assume it was SUDEP.
And autopsies aren't always done. They're expensive, they're invasive, and for a grieving family, sometimes they just want peace.
Exactly. But here is the tragedy. The authors of this paper argue that a significant portion of those probable SUDEP cases might actually be SWADAs.
They might be missed aortic dissections.
Think about the scenario. A person with epilepsy is found dead in their bed. There are signs they had a seizure overnight. No autopsy is performed. The cause of death is listed as probable SUDEP.
Okay.
But what if what really happened was this? The patient had a seizure. The seizure triggered a massive aortic dissection. The aorta ruptured. The patient died very quickly. Without an autopsy, what does it look like?
It looks like they had a seizure and died.
So we label it SUDEP.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a mysterious electrical stoppage of the breathing center. It was a mechanical blowout of their main artery. It was SWADAs.
Why does that distinction matter so much? I mean, dead is dead, right?
It matters because one is mysterious and feels like a bolt from the blue, and the other is a mechanical problem with identifiable and potentially preventable risk factors.
You can treat the hypertension.
You can protect the vasa visorum. You can act. Says SUDEP feels like fate. SWADAs feels like a medical problem we can solve. It gives us a target.
Let's talk about the fatality rate in this study because it really underscores the danger here, especially with aortic dissections.
It's grim. In the SUDO group, the seizure first group, there were 5 deaths out of the 18 cases. That's a nearly 28% mortality rate in this specific cohort.
And there was a specific terrifying pattern to those deaths, wasn't there?
Yes. All 5 of those deaths followed a first ever seizure, FES.
That is just
chilling.
These weren't people with chronic, uncontrolled epilepsy who had had thousands of seizures that weaken them over time.
No. For these 5 people, their very first seizure was their last. 4 of them were aortic dissections. 1 was a coronary artery dissection.
Why? Why would the first one be so deadly?
It might be because their bodies weren't adapted to it at all, but more likely it's because they had that silent accomplice we talked about, chronic hypertension.
The silent killer that weakened the vessel wall for years.
100%. The data point was stark. 100% of the SADO patients who died from an aortic dissection had a documented history of chronic hypertension. Their vessel walls were already brittle. The seizure was just the final push over the cliff.
I want to make this concrete for the listeners. We've been talking about anatomy and acronyms, but these are real people. The paper highlights a few cases that really stick with you.
They do. Let's look at the case of the TV watcher, which was reported by Oon and colleagues. This one haunts me because of how mundane and normal it starts.
Walk us through it.
It's 2013 or thereabouts. You have a 66-year-old man. He's at home. He's sitting on his couch with his wife watching television. It's a normal evening.
He's not exerting himself. He's not stressed. He's relaxing.
No. His wife is with him. And suddenly, she notices something is wrong. He starts sweating profusely. What doctors call diaphoresis. Just drenched.
Now, sweating can be a sign of a heart attack, right?
It can be. A classic sign. But before she can even really ask him if he's okay, his left arm jerks.
Mm.
A violent, involuntary spasm. And then he loses consciousness.
A seizure.
He's rushed to the hospital. Now, put yourself in the shoes of the ER doctor. You hear, 66-year-old man, sudden loss of consciousness, jerking arm. You're thinking, stroke or seizure disorder.
You treat the brain, you get a head CT.
Of course. But when they finally do a full workup, they find a type A aortic dissection, the most dangerous kind. The aorta had torn right at the root where it comes off the heart.
And the timeline.
He was fine 1 minute, the next, sweating and a seizure, then the dissection diagnosis. There was no ripping chest pain moment before the seizure that he told his wife about. The seizure or the autonomic storm that immediately preceded it was the event that ripped his aorta.
And he had a history of stroke, right?
He did, but that was an old stroke. It didn't cause the seizure in the traditional sense of a new lesion appearing. The timeline strongly suggests the seizure was the trigger for the dissection.
There's another case that is even more complex, the frontal cavernoma case. This one is fascinating.
Ah, the case from Pinardi and colleagues. This one is a masterclass in why you can't just assume brain lesion equals cause of dissection. You have to think about the timing.
So this was a female patient.
Yes. She had a known lesion in her brain called a cavernoma. It's a nasty little cluster of abnormal weak blood vessels in the brain. It had actually bled a year prior, so it was a known source of irritation.
So she has a known scar in her brain that could cause a seizure at any time.
A scar in her frontal lobe, yes. A seizure focus. She comes into the hospital with focal seizures. Her face is pulling to one side.
A classic focal seizure originating from that frontal lobe area.
Exactly. They do a full workup. And they find she has dissected both of her internal carotid arteries. Bilateral dissection.
Oh my God. Both sides of her neck.
At the same time.
Both sides. Now, a lazy, or let's say a traditional interpretation would be, oh, she has dissections. That must have caused a stroke, which caused the seizure.
But the cavernoma, the thing causing the seizure, was old. It had been there for a year. It was the known irritant that was starting the electrical fire in her brain. The lesion on her new MRI was unchanged from the one a year ago.
So the timeline is, old cavernoma causes seizure, right arrow, seizure thrashing, and the blood pressure spike causes the new neck dissections.
Exactly. The dissections were collateral damage from the seizure. If you just focused on treating the dissections, thinking they were the root cause, you'd miss the fact that her brain was the primary instigator and needed to be addressed to prevent it from happening again.
The paper also briefly compares these cases to the few trauma cases they looked at, just to make sure we aren't confusing things.
The control group. This was an important sanity check. They looked at 6 people who had dissections from clear trauma car crashes, falls, who also had seizures later.
And the timing was completely different.
Night and day. In the trauma cases, the seizure happened, on average, 81 hours after the accident.
That's more than 3 days later.
Right. So the sequences: crash, right arm traumatic brain injury, right arm swelling and inflammation in the brain, right arm seizure 3 days later. It's a delayed consequence.
But in Swatties,
it's simultaneous. The seizure and the dissection happen effectively at the same moment. It proves that Swatties is a unique physiological beast. It's not just trauma by another name. The mechanism is completely different.
So we've laid out the evidence. We've probably scared everyone sufficiently about the power of their own adrenaline. But as we always ask on the deep dives, so what?
The so what is the most important question. This is a fascinating paper, but what do we do with this information?
Why does this matter? If you're an ER doctor listening to this on your commute, what do you need to change tomorrow?
You need to change your first seizure protocol,
yeah.
Period.
Be specific.
If a patient comes in with a first ever seizure, FES, especially if they're middle-aged or older, and especially if they have a known history of high blood pressure, you cannot just look at the head.
Stop anchoring on the brain. Broaden the differential diagnosis.
You have to consider the heart and the great vessels. Listen to the chest carefully. Check blood pressures in both arms. A significant difference can be a sign of dissection. Check pulses in the arms and legs. Consider a D-dimer blood test, which can be elevated in dissection. And maybe, just maybe, if the patient is stable and the suspicion is high, consider a CT angiogram of the chest.
Because if you miss it.
If you miss it and you work them up for a seizure, give them some Keppra and send them home. You might be sending them home with a ticking time bomb in their chest. If that aorta ruptures at home, they die. If you catch it in the ER, you can call the vascular surgeon. You can save their life.
And what about for the patients listening? Maybe someone with epilepsy or someone who loves someone with epilepsy. This can feel overwhelming and terrifying.
It can. I understand that. But I actually see it as empowering because it highlights a risk factor that you can control.
The double hit theory you mentioned.
Exactly. We've established that chronic hypertension is the accomplice. It's the thing that weakens the wall so the seizure can break it. A seizure in someone with healthy, elastic arteries is much less likely to cause a dissection.
You can't always predict when a seizure will happen, but you can manage your blood pressure.
Precisely. If you have epilepsy, taking your blood pressure medication is not just about heart health in some abstract, long-term sense. It is about seizure safety right now. It is about bulletproofing your arteries so that if a breakthrough seizure happens, your vessels can handle the storm.
It integrates cardiovascular health directly into comprehensive epilepsy care. They aren't separate silos.
They are intimately connected. And of course, it also reinforces the absolute importance of seizure control itself. Taking your epilepsy meds as prescribed prevents the seizure, which prevents the catecholamine surge, which prevents the dissection. It breaks the chain at the very first link.
This has been a massive deep dive. We started with a simple, tidy medical assumption: dissection causes seizure, and we pretty much turned it completely on its head.
It is a true paradigm shift. We are moving from a simple linear model to a much more dynamic and frankly more frightening model of mechanical failure due to an electrical storm.
And we've put a name to it, SWATIS.
It's a name that needs to be in medical textbooks and ER protocols.
We should mention, as the authors did with great humility, that this is a retrospective study based on case reports.
Yes, absolutely. It has its limitations. We're looking backward at data that wasn't collected to answer this specific question. We need prospective studies tracking patients with first seizures in real time to confirm this definitively. Science is a process, not a destination.
But the signal is there. And it's loud.
It's too loud to ignore. It's a call to action.
I want to leave our listeners with a final thought. We often talk about the brain as a computer, the control center. It feels abstract, almost digital, like it's just software.
Yeah, we separate the mind from the body all the time.
But this paper reminds us that the brain is a physical force. It is not just software. It controls the hardware with an iron fist.
It can break the hardware.
A seizure is not just a glitch on an EEG screen. It is a storm so violent it can tear the very fabric of your body apart. It makes me wonder, looking back through history, how many unexplained deaths, how many sudden collapses that were just chalked up to a seizure or heart failure were actually this?
How many times did the body's own electrical storm break the machine it was running on?
It's a haunting question.
Yeah.
And one that I hope this new research helps us finally start to answer.
Knowledge is the only way we stop it from happening again.
Thank you for diving deep with us today.
Stay curious and maybe go check your blood pressure.
See you next time.